This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. We will visit with C.B. Fergunston, the Capitol Watcher, former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee and now a noted blogger. He'll have some comments about goings-on at the Capitol and beyond. The 5th District special election for the U.S. House of Representatives is getting interesting. We'll talk about it with C.B. Fergunston. Also, yesterday a major hearing regarding the oil and gas industry and a suit that was filed, and lawmakers in some venues across the state are not happy about the move by the group in the greater New Orleans area. Also, the LSU Board of Supervisors getting spanked by Judge Janice Clark. We'll talk about it with C.B. Fergunston. And C.B. says that come January, citizens in Louisiana may need passports to board commercial airliners. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. In just a moment, we'll hear from C.B. Fergunston, the noted Capitol watcher and blogger, and he has some comments about what's going on near and far away. I do want to note that yesterday we got the news just as the program ended that Jack Germond, a longtime columnist and commentator on American politics, who was a frequent guest on this show, about as frequent as C.B. Fergunston, he died at the age of 85. What a life he led. And today there are accounts of that magnificent life in politics and in journalism about Jack Germond in newspapers across the United States, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, you name it. Jack Germond's death is big news. And in the Baton Rouge Advocate as well. Notable in the Advocate is the omission of the fact that Jack Germond was a graduate of Baton Rouge High School, class of 1945, and attended Louisiana State University. And in days to come, we'll hear from some of the interviews done over the years with the great Jack Germond, but we will miss him. He was quite a man. C.B. Fergunston, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and yeah. C.B., you are a frequent blogger, as we know, and have been now for well over a decade. And today, as I do on most days, I read what you're up to, and you say that, surprise, surprise, some lawmakers don't care for you too much.
Yeah, and that's, Jim Bean, the retired editor of the Lake Charles American Press, and who still covers Baton Rouge during the legislative session, for the American Press, merely confirmed what I've long known, and in fact had been told by my own state senator years ago when I first started posting their voting records, that they really are angry with me and don't like it. And so, you know, that's public life. If they can't take it, I'll show them where the door to the kitchen is.
Well, I want to cover some ground with you that involves actions by the legislature or inactions. You say that come January, and this is a story that hasn't gained a lot of traction to this point, that when we get on airplanes, we citizens of Louisiana, we may need passports. Why?
Well, actually, Jim, it may happen any day now. That was the word of the TSA or somebody that, as was reported by the American Press in Lake Charles, that we'll be able to continue to use our Louisiana driver's license until 2014. But there's nobody that can confirm this. I've talked with the state police, Homeland Security at the state level, and various legislators who are directly involved in passing a law that could very well make our Louisiana driver's license not a proper ID to board a domestic airline flight. I'm not talking about flying out of the country. We know that takes a passport. But there was a law passed, I believe, in 2008 that prohibited the state of Louisiana or the Office of Motor Vehicles from complying with the federal Real ID Act, and the Federal Real ID Act it requires certain information to be contained in the magnetic card, magnetic strip on the back of our driver's licenses. And so we've gotten a bunch of deferments since then. We're not the only state, every state. This is a federal law. And we keep getting deferments, which, you know, it's just a matter, Jim, it's kind of like when Katrina hit New Orleans. We all had heard about the big one, but, you know, we didn't know when it was going to happen, and surely it wasn't going to happen while we were living there. But it did. And this is by no means in comparison to the disaster of Katrina. But it's one of those things that those of us who fly domestically and don't have passports may wind up at the airport one day, and there's a, you know, been another plane hijacking, God forbid, or something like that, and suddenly TSA says, we're going to enforce this this Real ID Act, and I'm sorry, you can't get on the plane using your driver's license, and it doesn't mean you can't get on at all. It just means you have to go through a lengthy process for identifying yourself, and if you're like most of us, you'll miss your flight because you'll spend about an hour or two, providing you there's no problem with the information, in getting clearance to get on the plane.
Okay.
So, and this is just, you know, the legislature knows about it, state police don't talk about it publicly, and it's just going to be a massive inconvenience because one day we're going to have to all get brand new driver's licenses.
And this story has not been reported in many places, but CB is telling us that sometime soon this could be a factor. Let's hope that it doesn't occur when you or I are on an airplane.
Exactly. And, you know, it will require legislative action to fix it. The current deferment for the Real ID expired last month. So right now we're just betting that it's not the TSA or the federal government's not going to crack down on the flyers right now. But they could at any time because there's no official deferment. And my concern is the lack of warning due to some incident occurring dealing with airline flight. And suddenly they crack down, and then there's these huge backup of lines. And and even if they change the law today, hundreds of thousands of us getting new driver's license at the same time is going to be a huge problem. So to me, why the legislature continues to ignore this issue, I don't understand it. It needs to be fixed. Or we need to be told it can't be fixed and go get yourself a passport or some other kind of ID that has the information that complies with the Federal Real ID Act. I just don't like things hanging out there that, you know, could suddenly come back at the worst possible time. Let's say I had a business meeting and I had to be out in California or even worse, let's say there was a individual that was sick in my family and I had to go see him and time was of the essence. Well, TSA is not going to give me an exemption, and if I miss my flight, I have really created some problems for myself and others.
Okay. 297-5633, your number, as we move along with CB for Gunston. And since we last visited with CB, we know now that we will have an election in Louisiana in 2013, one we didn't anticipate a few weeks ago, but boom, it's here, an October 19th primary for the 5th District Congressional seat. And CB, you have indicated that you have given this race some prayerful thought and consideration.
I have, but I hate being rushed, Jim, and I really haven't. I wasn't prepared to make a decision that I wasn't running for the 5th Congressional District. But now, on your show today, just being jammed up, I'm forced to announce that I'm not running for the 5th Congressional District.
So that's a big story. I'm sure we'll be reading about it. But, CB, many others are running. And the governor, who hasn't said a whole lot about what's going on, has given a job to the man who just resigned, Rodney Alexander, and some are crying foul. Is that valid, or is this just piling on our governor?
No, it's absolutely valid, Jim. I mean, to call a quick election like this with the only person having any warning was Neil Reiser, the state senator, who's one of Governor Jindal's loyal legislators. I mean, it just stinks. It just stinks. There's no other way to put it. This was fixed, and I think Neil Reiser to participate in such an event doesn't have the integrity to be a congressman from Louisiana. I just think everything about it's wrong. There's nothing that can be said. Rodney Alexander, clearly when he announced about a week ago that he was not seeking reelection, had no intent to not serve out the remaining year and a half of his term. The next day, suddenly, he announces his resignation. Bobby Jindal, at the last minute, sends out an addendum to a press release that he had sent out earlier that day that he was going to hold a meeting or a press conference to announce that Rodney Alexander would be the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs in Louisiana. I mean, there are just too many coincidences for this not to have been planned. And I think it was all put together in about 24 or 48 hours by Timmy Teeple and Rhett Davis, who are Bobby Jindal's two of his top political operatives. And, you know, that's life. Nothing illegal about it. Just wrong. And I hope there's a huge backlash by the people in the 5th Congressional District that won't let Neil Reiser get away with this.
Well, he would be the highest-ranking official from the Columbia area since John Julian McKithen, who was a guy that you and I admired. So you never know. Maybe Congressman Reiser, as many believe he will soon be, will rise to the occasion. A little play on words there.
Pun intended.
Now, Rodney Alexander, why does a man give up being a congressman? That's a pretty good gig to come back and be head of Veterans Affairs. You say follow the money. Why should we follow the money?
Because that seems to be the driving factor in this process for Rodney Alexander to suddenly leave Congress making $170,000 a year and want to take a state job, basically a step down in influence and power. And so, I started looking around, and Rodney Alexander was asked the question by the media in Monroe when he announced that if he was a member of the state retirement system, known as LASERS, LASERS, it's an acronym. And he said no. Well, everybody assumed, well, he's not a member of LASERS, then he's just taking a job that's paying $170,000 and taking a job that pays $130,000 so he can move back home to Louisiana. Well, that just didn't fit with what I know. So I contacted LASERS. Sure enough, Rodney Alexander, when he was in the legislature, the House, Louisiana House, had become a member of LASERS for about a year. Then he dropped out, got his money back, and the money, not a lot of money, because it's based on, his 8% or whatever it was at the time of about a $25,000 a year legislative salary. So he got his money. Then a few years later, he joined LASERS again, stayed in for a few more years, and then got out, I believe, about the time he was first elected to Congress and got his money back. So I asked LASERS, I said, is Rodney eligible to get back into the state retirement system? And they said, yes, he is.
All right, hold that thought. C.B. Fergonston saying that Rodney Alexander, the soon-to-be ex-congressman, is padding his retirement by moving out of Congress and back to state government. We'll talk more in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is your number wherever you are. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, as we continue our conversation with C.B. Forgonston, Capital Watcher, blogger, and former chief counsel for the House Appropriations Committee many moons ago, state legislature, a guy who follows Louisiana politics quite closely. And a few years ago, 2008, Richard Baker, who had served in the U.S. House of Representatives since 1987, he abruptly resigned in the middle of his term to become head of the National Hedge Fund Association, $1 million a year job. And this year, in a similar move, Rodney Alexander quits to leave Washington and to come home to be head of Veterans Affairs, a move that on the surface would appear to be a lateral move at best. But C.B. Forgonston says it will make Rodney Alexander smile on payday. Why so, C.B.?
Well, I've confirmed with the state retirement system attorney that Rodney can rejoin the state retirement system and get back all of the years that he served in the Louisiana legislature for merely putting up what he put in as a state legislator based on his salary at the time. So that would be roughly, I think, 7 or 8% of $25,000 a year for 15 years, and that would be calculated on the basis of his benefits would be calculated based on the state legislator's special retirement benefits at that time, which are 3.5% per year. So that would put him already over 50% of his highest 3 years of salary. Well, his highest 3 years of salary in the legislature would mean he'd get about probably $15,000 a year. But he can now average in 2.5 years at $130,000 a year and retire after serving 2.5 years as Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And my calculation is, and I didn't get this from Lasers, but just my top-of-the-mind calculation, probably retire for the rest and draw for the rest of his life just from the state retirement system about $70,000 a year, on top of his federal retirement system as retirement benefits as a congressman. So that's not a bad investment to come back to Louisiana and suddenly be able to go from maybe a $12,000 or $15,000 a year retirement to $70,000 for just 2.5 years' work.
Okay.
So there was plenty in this for Rodney.
Here's a question from Ben Balser. He says, where did the passport requirement come from, and what is the justification for it?
It's not mandatory that you have a passport. It's under the Real ID Act, which, by the way, was passed under George W. Bush. And it's just been delayed and delayed and delayed since it was passed. The law says that if you don't comply with the Real ID Act, meaning having certain information embedded in the magnetic strip on the back of your Louisiana driver's license, then you have to use an identification that does contain the information. And one of those is a U.S. passport. If you can find another ID, and I have no idea what it would be, that contains the information required by the Real ID, the federal act, then you can use that ID. And I don't understand if the passport, a U.S. passport, contains all the information in it. I don't understand why our legislature has said we don't want that same information in your driver's license. I mean, I can't see the black helicopters.
297-5633, John in Lafayette. John, you're on the air with C.B. Forgonston. Good morning, John.
Yes. Good morning, Jim. Good morning to C.B. I apologize for I tuned in just a minute ago, and you probably have already covered the subject. My question had to do with the oil company lawsuit. And what I'm hoping someone in authority, someone with some prestige that people will listen to, will bring up the fact that a lot of scientists think that all this coastal restoration is all for naught, that eventually the South Louisiana is sinking, the waters of the oceans are rising, and all these restoration projects will be under the water in 100 years. And my question is, should we be devoting these billions of dollars that Mary Landrieu says she's gotten for Louisiana in offshore revenue in the future from more than 3 miles out?
All right. Should we spend money to restore the coast if it's inevitable that the coast is going away? And this suit, which I was going to get to with CB, a big hearing yesterday that lasted all day. John Barry got raked over the coals by lawmakers. This is the guy who is best known as a writer of Rising Tide among his works, and he's the vice president of the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority, East. They sue the oil and gas industry, CB, and boom, the governor and many others, including other levy boards, they're all over John Barry.
Yeah, well, there's two different points here. John raises one, that's the science of the issue, and then there's the law. And that's the two big issues. If I was representing one of the oil companies, I would offer to fix the problem very quickly, and this would mitigate the damage. I would agree, as an oil company, to dismantle the old river control structure up in central Louisiana and let the river take its natural course, and that would fix the coastline. That would allow the Mississippi River to take its natural course that man, primarily the federal government, has denied it to go down the middle of the state through the Atchafalaya Basin to the coast. Once that was done, then the land would build out naturally. So I would, if the oil comes, I'd say I'd be happy to pay for that cost. That will solve all the problems and, you know, end of story. It's up to you, because the federal government and others decided to try to control the Mississippi River with levees, and even John Barry in his book, The Rising Tide, admitted that it was in dispute then whether we should have levees or whether we should dredge the Mississippi River. So on the legal side, there's a very serious question in my mind that the flood authority has the legal standing to bring this lawsuit about a contract to which they aren't a party. And that's the basis. They supposedly have, the state has a contract with these oil companies, and the flood authority said the oil companies haven't lived up to that, even though they admit that the oil company is only about 30% responsible, and apparently they have the deep pockets, so that's who they're going after. But there's a myth being perpetrated by John Barry and others that the Flood Protection Authority somehow has constitutional standing, and it doesn't answer to the legislature and the governor, and that's just a complete misreading of the Constitution.
On this one, you're with Governor Jindal.
I don't know what Governor Jindal's exact point.
Well, he said the same thing you said.
Well, you know, even Bobby Jindal occasionally finds an acorn. So, you know, the law is the law, and I agree that they don't have any constitutional standing, and they are absolutely responsible to the legislature and the governor, because they are a statutory entity that can be dissolved at any point by a majority of the legislature.
Well, independent of this, I think the larger issue for some is how much influence does the oil and gas industry have on state government, and how our lawmakers act when it comes to anything that involves something that would be considered a possible impediment to the revenues of the oil industry?
Well, they have a tremendous impact, as would any industry that was the almost sole backbone of a state's economy. I'd say they have the same influence that the automakers held in Detroit. I mean, it's just a fact of life. I mean, you have more employees, and you have more citizens with more at stake. And, you know, the state lived off the revenues from the oil and gas industry for 50 years. So has tremendous influence. But that's not any different than any other industry that is the major industry in any state. But this is a legal matter. You know, I don't believe that the oil companies have control over the judiciary and certainly not the federal judiciary. All you have to do is look at what's happened to BP in their lawsuit, in the lawsuit against them. They're not getting any slack.
But they're continuing to fight, though.
They're continuing to fight, and they're continuing to pay billions of dollars. So, you know.
And to continue, continuing to make billions of dollars, too. Their revenues.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are enormous.
Yeah. Paul and I hope they continue to make it because they'll never repair. Think about it. If I'd done that same damage, if I'd gone out there and little independent oil guy and gone out there and blown up my rig and spilled all that oil, I wouldn't have the wherewithal. I'd just declare bankruptcy. I wouldn't have the wherewithal to repair the coast, and we need them to keep making money.
Paul in Opelousas. Paul, you're on with Defender of the Oil and Gas Industry, C.B. Scottston.
Paul. Hi, how you doing, Jim? How you doing, CB? I work in the oil and gas industry. I just want to make that clear. I'm in the Krotz Springs area. But getting back to Representative Alexander, which is my representative, two questions. Why is the district so long, from North Louisiana down to Plaquemine, I think, and we barely ever saw Mr. Alexander in our district? Thank you very much,
all. All right. What about, he says he rarely saw Rodney Alexander in Opelousas, and why is Opelousas in a district that's largely in North Louisiana?
For political reasons. Because that's the way Senator Bob Costelka, who handled the reapportionment, wanted it. He wanted to make sure that they maintained two congressmen for North Louisiana, and they wanted one for northwest Louisiana and northeast Louisiana, and that's how they had to draw the district. I mean, if you look at the 5th Congressional District, it's kind of amazing. Just looking at a graph of it on the state, it looks like half the state is in that congressional district, and you know, geographically. And I don't know why anybody would want to represent it. Think about this. Rodney Alexander lived in Quitman virtually in northwest Louisiana. The district runs all the way down to Washington Parish. Actually, it stops and it comes down and is about, you know, ends about 10 miles north of Hammond and then goes all the way over to Opelousas. I mean, you'd need a helicopter to get around there.
Mm-hmm. You're familiar.
But
it was
purely politics. That's why.
Well, of course it was.
Drawn.
But CB knows where Quitman is.
Yep.
Not all that far from Newellton.
That's right.
297-5633. Here's an observation from John Williams. He writes, what about the years that Rodney Alexander had as a police juror? Wouldn't Rodney transfer those into lasers also and up his retirement even more?
I wasn't aware of all that, but yes, absolutely he can. He can buy back that time. And I don't know if he served active duty military, but he was in the reserves. But if he served in the Air Force active duty, he can buy that time back, too. So, you know, the $70,000 is just, like I said, just top of the head with the information I know. I mean, he could easily boost that up to $100,000.
You think he'll run for governor?
No. I think that's a joke. I mean, he's got to stay in this office 2.5 years to get that $130,000 based as the base of his retirement benefits, and he cannot, even in Louisiana, you can't run for public office while on the state payroll. So he would have to resign. And although he's getting a lot of good name recognition right now, but I'm not good. He's getting name recognition, but it's all bad. He's going to have to spend at least a year on the campaign trail, so I don't think that's even possible. I mean, his saying that's no different than everybody else who said they might run for governor. And in fact, it's reached the point where I'm counting down the days until Rodney announces he's not running for governor.
Well, he may announce that he's not running about the same time you do.
I'm going to try to coordinate with him on that. We can save the media some time.
Okay. Walt on Perkins. Good morning, Walt. You're on with CB for Godston.
Good. Thank you. I would like to make a comment on something you said a minute ago about the oil companies making billions of dollars.
Yes, sir.
That's true, but let me take ExxonMobil as an example, from whom I retired after 40 years. People look at them and say, wow, they made $40 billion. Yeah, but you got to look at the fact that that was on probably $450 billion in revenue. So they're only keeping about a dime out of every dollar that they make, which is not unreasonable. A lot of companies make a whole lot more than that. And then ExxonMobil turns around and hands out half of that to shareholders in the form of dividends. And last time I looked, the broadcast industry, the cable industry, was making way more than 10 cents on the dollar, and they were not turning around and handing half of it out to the public as dividends. So, yeah, we all get this awestruck tone in our voices about they make billions of dollars, but you have to put in that in the perspective of, as a business proposition, making 10 cents on the dollar is not unreasonable.
Well, there's nothing wrong. We live in a capitalistic society with making lots of money, and the oil and gas industry makes lots of money, but if they've torn up the coast, shouldn't they be paying for what they've done?
I am not going to make any decisions about that.
Oh, so you're okay with them making millions of dollars, but you're not okay with them being held responsible for the damage they've done to the people of this state.
I did not say it was okay. I said I'm not going to make a decision about that because I don't consider myself an expert. I am enough expert to read an annual report and say, making 10 cents on the dollar is not an unreasonable level of profit.
You're right about that. There's some media entities who make more, and there are others who make a lot less. Newspapers are not doing so well right now.
Oh, absolutely. And when we get electric cars and nuclear power, the oil companies will go the same way as the newspapers are right now.
They'll adjust. I'm sure they'll be involved in that as well.
Well, Exxon used to say that it was an energy company, not an oil company. And, given that I'm hoping to pass on a lot of ExxonMobil shares to my kids and grandkids, I hope they're right.
I don't think Exxon's going anywhere, Walt, so hopefully you've got a lot of stock and your kids and grandkids will do well, and there's nothing wrong with working for the oil and gas industry, and I'm sure you did so with great nobility and success.
Yeah, don't get me wrong, I'm not an unmitigated oil business defender. I can tell you some stories myself, but
we'll save those for another day.
We just need to keep balance.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay.
We'll be back with CB for Godston after this timeout. 297-5633, your number, back in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. CB for Godston with us for just a bit longer. Another story that I think is worthy of CB's reaction. State Judge Janice Clark of Baton Rouge delivered a rebuke to LSU's Board of Supervisors yesterday, finding the board and its chairman in contempt of court for ignoring her order to make public records from its secret presidential search. She has fined the board $500 a day for each record, each day the records are not produced. CB, your response.
Well, Judge Clark and I are old friends from way back, and I don't always agree with her, but in this case, she nailed it. I long before she made her ruling that the LSU Board of Supervisors, were in contempt of court, I knew they were in contempt of the taxpayers and the citizens of the state because they continued to ignore our wishes and hiding the fact that who applied to be president of our alma mater is just beyond the pale. Not only is it against the law, it's just flat wrong. And I'm sick of the Board of Supervisors thinking they're above the law and doing what the hell they want to and ignoring the wishes of the public. And so I think they should have long ago turned over those records, and I, you know, hopefully they won't try to destroy the records, because we will eventually get to see them. And the more they try to hide, the more the LSU Board of Supervisors tries to hide it, the records, the more I want to see them. And I just don't get it. I mean, right now they have cost the Board of Supervisors has cost the taxpayers $46,000 in fines to the court for merely refusing to give us the document. That money is not going to come out of the LSU Board of Supervisors' pockets. It's coming out of mine and your pocket. And, you know, I just don't get this Board of Supervisors. And I went to LSU back in the dark ages in 1962. I started there and have had some sort of interaction with the LSU Board of Supervisors since then. And I have never seen a Board of Supervisors with such disrespect for the courts, the public, lawmakers, you name it. I mean, they answer to nobody but Bobby Jindal.
297-5633, a few more minutes with C.B. for Gunston. Paul on Florida Boulevard. Paul, you're on the air with C.B.
Good morning. I was wondering if Mr. Forgotten would care to comment on the state of politics in America when a guy like Rodney Alexander can vote 40 times for legislation that has no chance of ever becoming law, but is considered a moderate.
Well, the state of politics in America today is pretty bad, because I find, for the most part, that those who are elected to represent us never consult with those they are supposed to represent. They get to Washington or Baton Rouge, and they make their deals among themselves, and representative democracy has just gone into become non-existent in America, much less Louisiana.
Getting back to the previous caller before the break, Walt, on Perkins, he called and defended the industry he's affiliated with, and I kind of like it when somebody gets their back up and they call and they defend something that's been good to them and he thinks has been good to the state, and I'm sure the oil and gas industry has been good to Louisiana in many ways. But more than a couple of people have commented that you've got many of our government officials, CB, who are constantly railing about big government, and yet they've never held a job outside of government. David Vitter, Bobby Jindal, they're two who dislike government, but yet government and the taxpayers have been very good to both of them, for example.
I agree with you 100%. I wish there was a requirement. There are very few requirements to hold public office in Louisiana, but I wish there was a requirement that you had some practical experience in the world. I don't care whether it's running a business or working for a business or whatever. But as Jim points out, we have some of our top officials in Louisiana with no practical experience in the world. And it's really hard for somebody to relate to that. I mean, I can't relate to the problems with dust storms up in the Midwestern states. I really have a hard time relating to that just as much as they probably have a hard time relating to flooding in Louisiana.
Well, for the governor to criticize government, this would be akin to the CEO of Exxon criticizing the oil and gas industry.
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's one thing if you have decided to be in government to fix something, but what exactly is your plan to fix it? And then you can criticize, but you know, point out a problem and show me what your plan is to fix it. That's appropriate. But just say, you know, because I'm a Republican or because I'm a Democrat, I'm supposed to think a certain way. It doesn't wash.
Well, another listener points out about this Rodney Alexander situation. Does he have the right to refuse his pension?
Oh, absolutely.
He would
have to get back into the retirement system.
I
never said he had. I'm merely saying that he can. Now, he's got until the last day that he is Secretary of Veterans Affairs to get into the retirement system. So we won't really know I mean, he hasn't been asked the question, will you, and this is the key question, Rodney, will you to now or ever in the future rejoin the state retirement system? That is the question that nobody is asking.
Lastly, the Department of the Treasury has sent final demand letters to 19 non-governmental organizations that have yet to comply with obligations under the law, according to Treasurer John Kennedy. You have followed this story quite closely.
Yes, and I've taken a little different tact than Treasurer Kennedy. Treasurer Kennedy is doing his job as state treasurer, trying to collect from agencies that are non-governmental agencies but are actually private organizations that agreed to certain conditions in order to get state money and have not complied. My point is solely that this is an indication of our legislative priorities, and all of these nonprofit private groups are a higher priority to our legislators than are our colleges and universities and healthcare in Louisiana. And people say, I've had legislators say, well, CB's talking about past history. No, I'm talking about the 2014 fiscal year budget that was passed in June of this year, which contained millions and millions of dollars for private entities, and while cutting higher education by $70 million. It's unconscionable. But my point is, I want the public to know what their legislators consider their priorities.
CB, thank you as always. Good to talk with you. Let's talk again soon.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
Bye-bye. 297-5633 is your number, and we switch gears just a bit, and we're joined by a gentleman who has worked almost three decades at Ford Motor Company, and I must preface our discussion by saying that I have no affiliation at all with Ford Motor Company. They're not a client of me or any company I'm involved with, but this is an interesting story, and the gentleman we're talking with, Richard, let me make sure I've got your last name pronounced correctly before we begin. It's C-U-P-K-A, that is?
But it's pronounced Cupty, thank you.
Cupty.
Cupkey, yes.
Interesting.
Like it had an E on the end, but it's got an A.
Okay.
Okay.
Richard Cupkey, 27 years at Ford Motor Company, and you're involved in CNG conversions. Is this something that's the wave of the future?
Well, we think, and we've seen a tremendous growth of it in our commercial vehicles. We've been into this pretty heavy for the last 3.5 years. We did it, I want to say it had a first time around back in the 90s and early 2000s, but the price differential between natural gas and gasoline was not great. They were essentially equivalent, so there was no real incentive to do it. But now we're seeing a huge difference between gasoline and natural gas. So a lot of commercial operators have decided they're going to power their fleets with natural gas, which is available in abundance in the U.S.
Are other automakers involved with this, or is Ford leading the charge?
Well, I want to say we've sold far more than the other guys, but General Motors does have some product on their full-size van and on a three-quarter ton pickup, and Dodge does a three-quarter ton pickup. We at Ford here, every one of our commercial vehicles, from the smallest Transit Connect, which is like a small delivery van, if you've seen those around, up through our big F-650 medium truck, are all available with engines that will run on either natural gas or propane.
Well, what is the price differential right now for these types of vehicles?
Well, it depends on where you're at in the country. In Baton Rouge right there, you guys seem to be charging anywhere from $1.52 to about $2.10, so with an average somewhere around $1.69 or $1.70 a gallon for what we call a gas gallon equivalent for natural gas. Now, in some areas, Oklahoma, it's only 79 cents a gallon out there.
For these, ahead. The vehicles themselves, what is the cost difference to get in a vehicle that's equipped?
Well, typically, in our case, the special engine, which has special components in it, costs $315 to $325 over the normal engine price. And then depending on the vehicle and the size tank you get, the upfit after the vehicle's been produced, and we have seven companies that we work with that do that, ranged from about $5,900 up to about $9,500, depending on how big of fuel tanks you want, things like that.
Well, let's turn the clock ahead a decade, Richard. In 2023, will these vehicles be plentiful on the roads? Will we see more of them than the traditional kinds?
Well, we've actually seen over the last 3.5 years, our sales of these vehicles, well, just starting out here, but they've been doubling every year. We've sold about 32,000 of them in the last 3.5 years. And I think that with the prevalence of the gas, the abundance of it, and then, of course, there's controversy around it, but the discovery of the shale gases and the ability to do horizontal drilling and the hydraulic fracturing has opened up what is essentially a several hundred year supply of natural gas for the country. And it's a U.S. fuel, so we don't have to, you know, get it from a country where we may not be getting along with the people there. And so I think that it's going to continue to grow tremendously. One of the biggest things for the adoption will be infrastructure. Now, Baton Rouge, you have dozens of natural gas stations around. There's a lot of places in Oklahoma, Texas, California, up the East Coast that are very prevalent. But there are areas in the country where, like South Dakota, has no stations. So what has to happen is the infrastructure has to continue to grow, and it is doing that now. They're opening 200 to 300 stations a year around the country.
That's really not enough to sustain a whole lot of vehicles, though. And the 32,000 sounds like a big number, but over 3.5 years, you say Ford has sold, what, 32,000 of these CNG-type vehicles. How many total vehicles have you sold?
Oh, well, gosh. We sell 4 to 5 million per year.
So it's a small 12 to 15 million. Number. Yeah, small number.
Yeah, well, Ford Motor Company is 4 or 5 million. The market is anywhere this year between 14 and 16 million units for the whole country. So it's a small percentage right now, but it is growing. And there's a couple of things about it. One, besides the reduced cost, but the other is that if you have a requirement from a municipality or a state government for greenhouse gas reduction, a natural gas vehicle burns emits approximately 30% less in total greenhouse gas emissions, about 19 to 21% of carbon dioxide less.
297-5633 in our remaining moments with Richard Kupke. He is the Ford Sustainability Program Manager and has worked almost 3 decades at Ford. As you can hear from his voice, he's also a radio guy. Hosted a show called Trigger Talk, didn't you?
Yes, I do. That's right.
Still do.
I do.
Well, from an environmental standpoint, air quality and that sort of thing, do these types of vehicles have significant merit?
Yes. Carbon dioxide emission reduction is about 19 to 21%, and overall greenhouse gas is about a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. So not only can an operator reduce their operating cost by running on natural gas, but they can also be friendly for the environment.
Now, the average vehicle in the United States, I think, averages about 23 miles a gallon on the highway. These types of vehicles average how many miles on a tank of gas?
Well, they will get an equivalent economy. So, for example, if you're driving a F-Series that gets 21, you'll get 21 on the natural gas. Typically, we see with the average tank size they get between 225, 260 miles of range on natural gas. But our most popular conversions now are called bi-fuel, where the vehicle runs on natural gas primarily, but when the tank runs empty, it switches back to gasoline seamlessly. You don't even notice it.
So, and you say the cost for a gallon is much less.
Considerably less. Depending on where you're in the country, it's usually at least 40% less and up to 75% less.
All right. Well, it's certainly something that I'm sure will have some traction, but you're really not able at this point to determine how much it will have in the next decade or two, but 32,000 in the last 3 years, you think that number is going to go up exponentially?
I'm sure it will be. All the manufacturers are getting more involved with it. There is a passenger car that's the only passenger car that's manufactured right now is the Honda Civic, which has a 8-gallon natural gas tank in it. But some of our vehicles now, like the F-Series that we just recently announced, the Lincoln MKT for limousine versions and things, those are all starting to pick up. So we see a bright future in the natural gas.
Well, Richard Kupke, we thank you and look forward to see where this is going. It certainly will be a wave of the future, and it may be something that will become commonplace before you and I end our lives.
Well, my pleasure being here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure, too. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for J.C. Kane, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.